Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Human Trafficking and Sexual Violence Coordinator Victoria Neville Babla and ADAPT Counselor John Crownover, both with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services, to talk about the sexual exploitation of boys and young men. Tori, John, welcome to Unscripted, and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Kendra.
Thanks for having us.
Before we start, listeners, I want to let you know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. We assumed it was happening mostly to girls, it being sexual exploitation and victimization in this country's sex trade. We were wrong. Research has found more than one-third of young people involved in the U.S. sex trade are boys and young men, with Black and brown males and LGBTQ+ young people at higher risk, and the problem is vastly underreported. So, Tori, I'm going to start with you. Define sexual exploitation, just a general description, no matter what the gender of the victim is.
Yeah, of course. So I can say it's a sort of a situation where we see individuals being manipulated into sexual activities for the financial or otherwise gain of another person. What we're really looking for is three Fs, force, fraud, or coercion when it's an adult victim. Actually, for children victims, they cannot consent to any commercial sex act. So we don't need to show that force, fraud, or coercion for kids. And the benefit or financial gain can also be, you know, not just straight cash, but it could be drugs, it could be a place to stay the night, or a trade of some other sort. So we really see this play out in really unique situations, and every situation can look totally different.
When you say young people, kids, children cannot consent, what's the age? What's the cutoff age?
That's age 18. So minors cannot legally consent to any commercial sex act.
Okay. Folks in the field are telling us that teen boys are the fastest growing segment of human trafficking victims. Let's attempt to break this down. Why do we think this is trending now? I hate to use trend because that sounds like it's a fashion statement. Why do we think this is happening now, or has it always been like this and we just didn't know it?
Yeah, I think part of it is, yes, it has always been happening. But we have, first responders and, the media, everything kind of plays a role in kind of perpetuating, the myth that girls are only and always the victims and men or boys are often just the perpetrators in this. And so when trafficking victims are coming in, the girls are being identified, but the boys are not. And I think this has just been typical in terms of services around any type of sexual exploitation, that boys have generally been overlooked. Greater stigma often around coming forward for boys too, because of those societal beliefs about, men are strong, men can't be victims. And I think that impedes often boys coming forward as well as victims.
We've also seen an increase in recent years for online recruitment. So there's a UNH study that estimates that about 70% of commercial sexual exploitation of children happens or starts online. For decades and decades and decades, girls are getting taught, stranger danger, and then more recently, online safety. Boys might not be getting the same speeches from their parents, from their community, from their teachers. And so we do see on average that there are more victims per perpetrator. So things like catfishing, where maybe somebody who's causing this harm pretends to be someone else online and tries to get these images. We've seen lots of cases where there can be dozens, if not, potentially hundreds of images of children taken from a single person causing this harm.
Yeah, I think the issue of sextortion, which is something that the FBI and the National Center for Missing and Exploited children have really identified having kind of skyrocketed since the pandemic, or maybe increase access to the internet and supervised internet time, particularly, for children and teens, has really kind of exploded. And I think, as Victoria said, that parents are often overlooking those kinds of conversations and to kind of help build up those kind of protective factors for kids to kind of be warned about what are some of the red flags that they should be looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Even in NOVA, Northern Virginia, we have a ICAC, Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and they saw an increase from 5,000 to 7,500 in recent years, with a particular increase amongst Hispanic children as well.
Does exploitation present differently in boys than in girls?
I think in some ways, yes. I think, if you're talking about, as I probably mentioned, online exploitation or sextortion, we have seen an increase, particularly amongst boys, for that. And I think, coming forward, the kind of shame sometimes when somebody's being blackmailed or extorted as a result of that can often be greater because of this kind of perceptions and, that boys can't, be sexually trafficked or fall victims to that, boys were pursuing it in some way. And as Victoria said, if they're under 18, there is no consent at any stage with regards to this. And I think, there's a lot of shame often when that starts to happen. And sadly, in cases throughout the U.S., there's often an outcome for some young men who are particularly vulnerable to suicide as a result of that. I think the FBI, in one of their reports, highlighted, an increase of at risk for suicide due to that shame, due to that inability to seek help from, the adults in the lives of that child, be it parents, be it other caregivers, be it school staff, that can often put them at risk because of that shame that's associated with it.
Yeah, as John was saying on shame, it also is less likely to lead to disclosure with boys. So, for example, even when it comes to any form of sexual violence against boys, the Boy Scouts of America did a study where they found that the average age of disclosure was actually 55 years old, even though the majority of sexual violence against boys happens when they're under 18. So it just goes to show how many decades sometimes people will keep this to themselves, where they feel like they don't have that support. They don't have that trusted person that they can talk to, somebody who will believe them, somebody who won't make fun of them or shame them for what that they've gone through or question their masculinity or their manhood. I have this quote that I've heard that I think applies to a lot of situations of people who have experienced violence, but sometimes when it comes to male victims, I've seen it play out in maybe even more intense ways. And it's the quote, "Hurt people ask for help in hurtful ways." And so sometimes, instead of, maybe what we stereotypically associate with victimhood, like crying or being scared, sometimes we see young men and boys almost like having lashing out type behaviors that we as a society might criminalize, and we might punish, people who are actually victims because we're not recognizing that they're actually asking for help.
And I think, you touched on it earlier too, in terms of some of the data also showing, some communities are also maybe more leery of seeking support from law enforcement or coming out to law enforcement, with what's currently going on in society. That's probably raising increased fear. And so, being able to make a report or seeking help through, government institutions, may be more impacted by some communities.
What about crimes that they may have committed while they were being trafficked as part of survival, as part of they were being forced to do it, but after they're no longer, whether they're arrested or they have gotten out of the trafficking, out of being trafficked. What about those crimes? They're being arrested for them and charged with crimes that really aren't exactly crimes. I mean, they're crimes, but they're not their fault.
Yeah, definitely. So people who are doing the trafficking really exploit this, knowing that if they can, you know, get their victim to think, you know, they're at fault for the abuse that's happening for them, or to be committing crime, saying, you know, if you report this, you're going down with me, whether that might be forced drug trafficking, whether that might be, you know, engaging in like solicitation or what could be criminalized as prostitution. And until very recently, even children were getting charged with prostitution and with distribution of child sexual abuse images like child pornography. And so there is this perception for the victims and even for, you know, responders who may not have gone through training that the victims are actually criminals themselves, which, you know, really is a barrier for them asking for help or self-identifying as a victim. I, you know, in all of the years that I've been in this field, I've almost never had someone self-identify as a victim or, you know, use the words human trafficking or sex trafficking. They're usually in such a state of panic about, you know, just being in a really, really bad situation that they're just reaching out, asking for help. And it's only properly identified once it's, you know, gone through a couple layers.
And I think, as like Corey was saying, that particularly stronger in boys, in terms around self-identification, again, kind of, you know, falling into those kind of societal views of boys as victims, particularly around any type of exploitation. The perception that most exploitation is around labor, which is also kind of a false stereotype as well, versus sexual exploitation. So these are some of the things that they come up against when trying to think about whether they should seek help.
Exactly. And we do hope, you know, through listening to this podcast or through, you know, educating the general population and those first responders, that the victims can learn that help is available, whether it might be related to their immigration status, whether it might be related to a crime that they're being accused of or convicted of. There are vacature laws out there. There is relief for people who have had to, you know, break laws or go through these types of situations as part of their trafficking experience. So even if a victim might have been forced to commit a crime, they should still hopefully be able to receive that support. And that's what we try to do every day when we conduct these trainings.
We're going to take a quick pause, playing off of what you just said, Tori, to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, there is help. They can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. My research suggests or shows that there are very few male-specific survivor organizations in this country. I didn't check for international. It's probably the same internationally. You guys have both worked internationally, you would know. But are the needs of survivors, it sounds like the needs of survivors are different based on gender, but we don't have support specifically for males. So how do we address this?
I think, you know, there are a few organizations trying to raise awareness at the national level. There's an organization called One in Six that has been doing some work to kind of raise that awareness as well. But I think, yeah, the differences, you know, continue to be around, you know, often boys and young men not recognizing that they're a victim, and or, you know, the shame that we talked about earlier often having a large impact on them seeking support and services. And as a result, too, you know, institutions that often are the first responders not really having the tools or asking the right questions to identify potential victims of you know, sexual exploitation with that. I know that, you know, that's something that, you know, more training is needing to be done, more education, particularly with parents, schools, caregivers, as well, in order to identify some of the red flags. But we see, you know, that this, you know, sexual exploitation in particular at different ages, we could see it in some of the scandals that happened at universities and sports in terms of, you know, not just for female players, but also for male players as well, and the stigma in terms of for them to come forward, that a lot of that abuse was happening for over years, decades, before, you know, attention is put onto it.
Yeah, and I'll say on the resources specific piece, you know, I can't even count the number of organizations I know that are specific to supporting women or even girls. And I can only really think of one off the top of my head that's specific to men, which is Bob's House of Hope. I believe it's located in Texas. And I also believe last I heard it was the only male-specific shelter for victims of human trafficking.
Okay, so you guys are leading me to solutions. What are some potential solutions for this issue? Starting with more awareness, obviously, which we are working on today. But what are some other solutions?
I think there's a variety of solutions. And I know, you know, first starting off with, you know, improving communication with your teens, with your children, having conversations about healthy relationships. You know, DSVS has a lot of resources around that. We have a lot of work that we do in the schools and in the community around promoting healthy relationships amongst teens, but really opening up all of these topics to a conversation and not to a taboo. I think there are a lot of resources, maybe not a lot, but there are resources available to help parents have these conversations, both at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They have some documents, tips that could be downloaded in English and Spanish to particularly around sexualization and having conversations around that with teens, helping them to be able to identify red flags, you know, what happens if they have experienced or been targeted in some ways, and what are some things that parents can do to kind of, you know, again, rest assured that if their teens come forward and that the parent's not going to be angry, that the first line of business is the parents is going to be protect their kids, promote safety and get them support for that. And I think, you know, highlighting that's really important in terms of building those open channels so that, you know, kids can work through any stigma or shame that they might be feeling and come forward to, you know, positive adults in their lives to speak out about this if they've experienced it.
Yeah. And just like John was saying about education around healthy relationships for kids and parents, I would also add to that, you know, for online safety as well, and, you know, monitoring or having awareness of what sites and who kids are talking to using the internet, maybe reconsidering that unlimited access all the time, and also knowing, you know, well, what is a healthy relationship in terms of dating, but also what could be a healthy relationship or what are your rights in terms of work, because we also want kids and adults to know what their rights are and how to report in case they do see these labor violations coming through or any sort of exploitation when it comes to labor as well. I'll also say for trafficking and for abuse in general, looking at how we as a community and as a society can address some of these underlying needs and vulnerabilities, right? So thinking about, you know, what is the need that the trafficker is fulfilling in this kid's life or this young person's life? Is it that place to stay? Is it food? Is it, you know, attention and moral support? And so how can we actually address some of the real needs these kids have so that it doesn't feel like, you know, the only way for them to get their need met is through somebody who's trying to exploit them?
You guys have both mentioned first responders. What trainings are available for first responders? Let's talk just Fairfax County. What trainings do we have for first responders?
Yeah, I can speak to that as a member of the prevention education coordination team. So every year we have Human Trafficking Awareness Month with a proclamation as well as with an annual training. We have some great partners who come in. We've, you know, talked to some providers as well as to lawyers who are working in the field. We have a panel that comes through law enforcement, child protective services, mental health providers, lots of folks who are truly experts. And this is open to first responders. It's also open to the community. So anyone who wants to learn more about what's happening in Fairfax County, how they can get involved, we definitely encourage that everyone can come out. And even if you can't make the date, which this upcoming year will be January 15, 2026, starting at 1 p.m. So if that doesn't work for you, we also have speaks forums where different organizations, groups, for example, we've led trainings for, you know, teens in healthcare settings. We've led trainings for people from different religious backgrounds and faiths that want to do something with their, you know, religious community. So you can definitely request that on our website, and we're happy to, you know, send out whoever is the most tailored person to really deliver that training for whatever group or team or organization that you're a part of.
And the website is fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. Throwing that out there. What about peer-to-peer counseling? Might that be more effective than a professional to a victim survivor if it's someone that they can kind of relate to because they've been in this situation?
I mean, I think kids obviously learn a lot from each other. And so, you know, the more messaging that we're doing and raising awareness specifically to that age group and language that that age group connects and resonates with, I think could have more impact. You know, social media, whether TikTok or Instagram or whatever is the new one that's been coming out, are different ways to meet young people where they are, where they spend a good amount of time. So looking at how we can use social media also, you know, working with influencers could be another way of trying to broaden the message out to young people to be more aware of that. And so this really needs to be an all community response in terms of linking up with parents, you know, linking up with PTAs. You can also help raise awareness to educators in the schools, to sports groups and other community groups that young people interact with, and to those places that young people, you know, congregate, whether online or in person, and as kind of a all hands on deck to kind of raise awareness and spread the word.
We also probably need to help with job skills for some of these young men once they're out of, no longer being trafficked, once they've escaped that. Skills training, mental health work. I'm throwing stuff out here. You guys help me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, a study in Virginia as well showed that for men who had experienced sexual violence, only about 15% actually reported seeking help, like counseling. And so, like you said, you know, really looking at holistic ways to, you know, still work on somebody's physical and mental well-being without maybe that barrier of, you know, seeking out a licensed clinician could be helpful. We can also, you know, work to reduce that stigma so that hopefully more folks are able to disclose what's happening to them and they don't have to feel alone in it and they don't have to keep it inside. And then they can hopefully seek those resources. And hopefully as well, we work to make sure more resources are available to boys and men. If, you know, federal funding is for an organization, you know, the rules are that everyone has to be able to access that regardless of gender. So we should also, you know, make sure to ourselves be holding ourselves to a higher standard that anyone is welcome in the door, you know, regardless of how they identify. They should be welcomed and, you know, treated as, you know, a survivor and a victim if they so identify that way.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I mean, we're fortunate, you know, one of our sister agencies within the Department of Family Services is PAYS, Public Assistance and Employment Services. Mm-hmm. And they also have programs that specifically targeted young men and women for employment support and services. It could be assistance to finish school, you know, maybe due to the exploitation or the trafficking, you know, they were did not get to finish high school or their education, their support for that, as well as job training and education as well. So, you know, those are services that can be linked to efforts around, you know, counseling, therapy, or whatever other services that they may need within Department of Family Services as well.
Okay, I'm going to give both of you a chance to do this final takeaway. What do you want folks to take away from today's conversation? Tori, I'm going to start with you.
Oh, wow. Lots of pressure. Well, you know, off the top of my head, I just think, you know, there's so much that we can learn about this topic. It's so under-addressed. It's so under-discussed. And I think, you know, by having this conversation to begin with, I'm just hoping that that can open the door to more people being able to have these types of conversations, to be able to say, you know, either what happened to them or what happened to somebody that they love and that they care about, because it is happening even if people aren't talking about it. And for me, you know, part of the reason why I'm in this work to begin with is that I don't think anyone should have to feel alone in what they're going through. So again, I just hope that this conversation is able to open up some of those doors, just make it a little bit easier for, you know, if parents, teachers, healthcare providers, those people in our communities who are really the backbones of the communities, to let them know that, you know, it's okay to talk about these things. You know, it shouldn't be shame or stigma associated with it, but we're all out here just trying to be supportive of one another.
John, your final thoughts?
Yeah, it comes back to, for me, really to the word vulnerable or vulnerability, and broadening the scope of understanding that that can also be boys and young men as well. I think recognizing that vulnerability and allowing them to be able to connect with whatever they may be experiencing in a safe environment, whether in the home, with parents, you know, being supportive and understanding, schools as well, not just, you know, looking at some of the stereotypical lines about how boys and young men are just tough and stoic and, you know, only, you know, the perpetrators, but also recognizing that they are also victims of human trafficking, victims of sextortion, as well, and that we really need to kind of broaden our responses to make sure that we're providing the needed services and supports to them, and kind of breaking down some of the barriers, as Victoria mentioned, around kind of stigma and shame that still exists for everybody around those issues, but sometimes more specifically to boys and young men as well.
Okay. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Tori and John for their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.